Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Ad Lloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share, and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Thank you for listening to the Griefcast. If you like the show, please do rate and review and subscribe. Subscribe? It helps other people to find the show. And if you have done all those things already, thank you so much. Please reward yourself with your cake of choice. I would just go for a chocolate cake unless a fresh Victoria sponge was available. This week, I'm talking to stand-up and writer Ishan Akbar. Ishan is a So You Think You're Funny finalist. He sold out his debut Edinburgh show last year, and he also recently appeared on The Now Show on Radio 4. Ishan came in to talk to me last year about his mother, who passed in 2014. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm joined today by stand-up comedian Ishan Akbar.
Hello.
Hi, Ishan.
Hello.
How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Who are we remembering today?
Today we're remembering my mum.
Your mum. And when did your mum die?
She passed away on the 16th of May 2014.
Oh, so quite recently.
Yeah, very recently.
So you're coming up to... So you've just had 3 years.
Just had 3 years.
How was your 3 year? Was it a hard, easier, or better, or not harder?
It was an odd one because this year was my first time marking her passing whilst preparing for my first ever Edinburgh show.
Wow. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, so May was kind of when I started having those anxiety dreams that people say comedians mm-hmm. tend to have about Edinburgh, which it didn't dominate the month because as soon as May turns round, all I think about is my mother.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, it completely changed the tone of the way I remembered her.
Oh, yeah.
I found myself having, in my head, more anxious conversations with her.
Oh, wow.
About Edinburgh.
Yeah.
And trying to unremember her disappointed face when I chose to become a comedian.
Was she supportive of your... Because you became a comedian a bit late, I think, in terms you had a career before this,
yes.
rather than, you know, myself included.
Yeah.
I always get amazed when I see, like, 17-year-olds, like, I'm going to do stand-up.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
How do you know that's what you want to do?
Yeah.
So was she supportive of your choice of comedy?
She was. So I started comedy 2 months before she passed.
Wow.
It was just 2 months, and it was just an open mic hobby, basically, at the time. And my mum saw me kind of just pick up quite a few open mic gigs. And at that point, it wasn't amounting to anything necessarily. I hadn't even considered that I'd become a professional comedian anytime soon. So when she passed, actually, my mum's passing and my career in comedy pretty much go hand in hand. And I started pushing a career in comedy because my mum passed.
So did you feel like it gave you... a kind of, we've talked about this before on the podcast, a kind of a drive appeared of like, I feel like life is short or I want to make her proud. What was it that kind of suddenly made you go, right, I'm going to do this?
I think the life is short bit played a part insofar as when, so as you mentioned, I had a previous career. I worked in banking, I worked in local government. And at the time, I was working in banking again. And when she passed, there was that bit of saying, oh, life's really short and unpredictable. Mm. But my first gig was 2 weeks after she passed away. And that was in the same room and venue and competition that my mum saw me do comedy, the one and only time she saw me.
Oh.
To be honest, in terms of my having a career in comedy, it's entirely been because of some, it's going to sound really weird saying this, but signs that I felt I received.
I hear you. Yeah? I hear you.
Yeah. And so that first gig, was, like I said, same room, same venue, same competition. It was called the Golden Jester. It was a quarterfinal in London Bridge in Belushi's.
Oh, yeah, I know Belushi's, yeah.
And downstairs. And I remember going to my dad and brother 2 weeks after saying, do you want to go to a gig? And I mean, and my dad was like, you do know what's happened.
Like, I was like, yeah that's but, why I want to be cheered up.
Yeah, I don't know what else to do. Like, we just went. And I remember thinking I saw my mum in the audience when I went on stage.
Wow.
Stumbling over my first couple of words, but ploughing on through, and then I got into the final of the competition.
So you felt, I guess it's like a journey began that she saw. Did you kind of feel like you wanted to finish it in a way, like even though she wasn't there to see it physically?
Kind of. And I think as I reflect on my 3 years and I carry on going, I speak to my other friends about this. I know full well, because I lived with my mum, dad and brother, we all lived together.
Mm-hmm.
And I was incredibly close to my mum.
Yeah.
So much so 2 years ago, before she passed, 2 years before she passed, I started writing a novel about her life because she's had a really interesting life. Wow. So my mum and I were very, very close. And I know that had I wanted to pursue a career in comedy, she would have found that quite difficult. In truth, because I would have spent a number of evenings away. I would have gone, you know, it wouldn't have been easy for her.
Mm.
And in a weird way, her passing for me feels like her giving me her blessing to say, okay, this is something you want to do.
Yeah.
If I was here, I would have chewed your ear off about it. I wouldn't have enjoyed you being away like that. Mm. I'm not comfortable with those kind of things for reasons you know, and perhaps we'll explore in the podcast later. And so I take that as my kind of reasoning to do it.
Yeah.
I guess.
That's really interesting. I think a lot of people have that with career. Sounds like the wrong word in a way. Like, career's too narrow, isn't it? It's like your life passion. After someone dies, I think it does kind of narrow everything down slightly, and you go, okay, I kind of know what I need to do.
Yeah.
Because I've been shown life in its most harshest close-up view.
Yeah. So and the harshest close-up view is completely right. I remember I did the Say You Think You're Funny semi-final in August. So it was 3 months after my mum's passing, and it was a few days before my 30th birthday. Wow. So emotionally, it was just a massive emotional overload.
Yeah.
And it was my dad, myself, my brother, my brother's best friend. We were driving up to Edinburgh, and I basically spent the whole journey crying.
Oh.
Saying, I miss my mummy, I miss my mummy. And I got to Edinburgh, and then I started thinking about the gig, and it was the biggest gig I'd ever done at that point. It was my 28th gig.
Wow.
So your 28th gig is at the Gilded Balloon.
Oh, God,
in the main debating hall, and 400 people, and you're thinking, I've only ever done open mic gigs.
Yeah.
So I was crying, and Rob, who my brother's best friend, said to me, this isn't even the biggest gig you've done this year. And I said, I don't understand what you mean. And he said, the biggest gig you've done this year was when you were stood next to your brother inside your mother's grave, and they lowered her body into your arms, and there were 500 people there. And you had to climb out and see all these people. And that completely changed the game. I don't even know if Rob knows this, how much of an impact that statement had on me. Because when he made me remember that that's what I did with my brother, who's 10 years younger than me, he was 19 at the time, kind of people not laughing at your jokes becomes irrelevant.
Yeah.
So you can enjoy being in the moment a lot more. And it absolutely helped to making me a better comedian.
I mean, it's that really hard thing, because as part of you as a comedian, I think it's like, oh, this really does help with comedy.
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely.
It really does. Because you suddenly go, oh, none of it matters.
Yeah.
None of this shit matters.
No.
Because I know what does matter. And I've seen death, like we said, really up close, and it does make you go, oh, that's what matters.
Yeah.
So what happened to your mum? How did she pass away?
So it was a complete shocker.
Oh, really?
So the story goes as is. Sunday, 11th of May in the morning, my mum and I decided we'd go to Costco.
Classic
Sunday behaviour.
Excellent.
We watched a juicer exhibition.
I love those things.
Yeah, they're great. So it was good. Really good.
Yeah.
And we were driving back, and I do distinctly recall on the drive back thinking to myself, Mum and I have not had a single argument on this journey. This is weird, right? Then my mum, my brother and I went to have a pub lunch. We came back from the pub lunch, and my mum said, oh, you know, I've got a bit of a back pain, lower back pain. And I said, oh, Mum, just have a rest. It's because we've been walking around Costco all day.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I had a meeting at the BBC with a friend of mine, and we were about to start up an open mic comedy night, basically.
Right.
My mum got taken to hospital, nothing serious, just quite a bit of back pain, and it transpired that she had a minor kidney infection.
Hmm.
I went to work the next morning, called her, she was in hospital, she said, yeah, I'm fine, I'm just going to get your brother to bring a change of clothes, everything will be good, and that was at 10 in the morning. 11 o'clock, she called my brother, and at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, my dad called me crying, saying, I've just had to give your mum CPR in the hospital, and I've no idea why.
Oh, my God.
So the doctors then said, we've had to put her into an induced coma. We think she's had a silent heart attack and then a cardiac arrest, but actually we don't know what caused it.
Oh, my God.
And then by the Friday of that week, they said her brain stem had broken because the cardiac arrest was so severe. And then that Sunday after, we buried her.
Oh, my God.
One week.
Shit.
Complete chaos.
Is all I can say to you?
Yeah.
Ishan, bloody hell.
Complete chaos.
So, okay. So, was there to spare up.
Okay.
So, what did they tell you what had happened? So, she had the heart attack was just so massive. Is that why she died?
But basically. And, well, the death certificate said a septicemia of the blood.
Right, okay.
Which, as a result of... they were doing dialysis, giving her dialysis, and they stabilised her by the Tuesday.
Mm.
But on the Wednesday, Thursday, her organs just started failing.
Mm.
And the doctors weren't entirely clear. Mm. They didn't really understand what was going on.
Which is hard as well, because I think it's only when you've had someone close to you die that you realise... Often doctors just don't know.
Yeah, they don't.
You get up close and you're like, oh, I thought you fixed things.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
they
yeah,
just
absolutely.
Sometimes haven't got a clue why
they don't.
Something's happening.
And also, you know, doctors, I recently watched Adam Kay at the Soho Theatre.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it was a very powerful show. And actually, doctors, have you read Atul Gawande's Being Mortal?
I haven't, no.
So Atul Gawande's Being Mortal, he also explores the same thing. Doctors are grossly unprepared for death.
Yes, yeah, I can
Do you know
imagine.
What I mean? Because they're trained to avoid that happening.
Yeah, they're trained to save life. That's save it. Life, life,
that's
life.
It.
Life.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So when death occurs, more often than not, it becomes numbers. My dad's a paramedic, you know, they become numbers. But when a death occurs that's so unexpected, as it was with my mother, they don't quite know how to process it. I mean, yeah. On the Friday afternoon, as people were coming in to pay their respects in the hospital, my friend's family, the consultant took me into a room and just broke down in tears.
Wow.
With his gene doctor saying, we've not seen this kind of outpouring of love for someone. I wish we could have done more.
Oh.
So it was it's a week that, especially in May, I play through my head every day. And sometimes I'll get weeks where I just feel like I'm repeating the week again, and what happened and what I was doing. And every single day from that week is very, very vivid and clear in my mind.
Well, and also, having read a tiny bit on this sort of thing, like, that is how you deal with shock. You keep replaying it because your body is in shock. Because it doesn't make sense that someone is alive and then not there so quickly.
Yeah.
So your brain has to keep going, what? What?
Yeah.
So you have to keep replaying so that your brain eventually goes, okay.
Yeah.
I guess that happened because, that is so... So your dad's a paramedic.
Yeah.
So that's why he administered... Because I was like, wow, how did he know CPR?
And all the, you know, signs, we're talking about signs. My dad... I can't remember my dad taking a day off.
Wow.
And that particular Monday... I mean, Mum had been admitted to hospital before. She was a diabetic and she was a bit loose. She played it fast and loose with her health, in truth.
Right, yeah.
But... Nevertheless, we weren't unaccustomed to her going to hospital.
Right.
But that particular Monday, I didn't even know my dad was off.
Wow.
I thought he was at work.
Yeah.
And when he called me from the hospital saying, I was next to your mum and I gave her CPR. And he brought her back after 3 rounds.
Oh, my God.
And of course, the doctors had to kind of chuck him out.
Yeah,
and say, you can't treat your own family members. But this is
not normal.
This is not normal. So... that's the long answer. The short answer was basically she had a silent heart attack and a cardiac arrest, led to septicemia of the blood, and she passed away. But that kind of masks the unprecedented, unexpected nature of what happened.
We talked about this a lot, but when someone has cancer, there's obviously the word which prepares everybody. They have cancer, they're ill, they're even, as I say, every time my dad was diagnosed in February, dead by the April, so it's quick. But we all knew, okay, there's an illness. But I think something like heart attack, it is so shocking because, like you said, they're not ill with capital letters. They're like, something's wrong, or they're having this, they'll get some antibiotics, they'll be home.
Absolutely. Around a similar time, about a year later, another comedian friend of mine, his mother passed away with cancer. And in a sense, it was quite fortuitous for both of us because we were able to talk to each other about it. And he did say to me very much the same thing, which is with his mother, when she was diagnosed, they had time to prepare. Mm-hmm. And actually, she ended up living longer than the prognosis was. And he just says, you know, I don't know how I'd process losing my mum the way you did.
Yeah.
And... by the same token, I sometimes think to myself, if I'd known, were there conversations I could have had with my mum and prepared, would I prefer? The truth is, Karen, I don't know.
You don't. You can't
you know,
say,
I don't.
Yeah.
I've no idea.
And I think, neither is good.
Yeah.
But if you get a long, if there's a long time where you know, yes, you can have conversations, but you have to watch someone be very sick.
Mm.
And if it's quick, that's what the people who have the long experience say to me, oh, but I had to watch this pain. And the quick people are like, yeah, but you got chats.
Yes, so it's
Oh, you know, I don't think either is particularly, you don't want either really, but in a way you don't have to see someone suffer in pain. But you don't get those last conversations. You think, oh, I wish one thought, I didn't kind of finish that conversation.
Yeah. It's and that's tough. A very interesting point about not seeing someone sick and frail. My mum was 54 when she passed. And my brother, he always reflects that the thing that he's grateful for, if you can be in such a situation, is that neither of us will know mum to be massively sick.
Yeah.
But also, we won't remember her being old.
That's very true. I've never thought about that. Yeah.
And, you know, we'll always... remember her youthful face and her 54-year-old face, and that gives us a lot of solace, actually. And I'd love to have my mum around forever. And when I think about one day having kids, the fact that she, you know, she would have been such a wonderful grandmother.
Yeah.
I think about that often. But at the same time, in terms of maybe her legacy is going to be stronger because I'll be telling, if I ever have kids one day, hint, hint, anyone out there, that they'll know this woman through my yeah. brother and I, the stories they hear. And sometimes I make someone...
It's really hard. I mean, I've just had a baby. And so my mum, thank God, is still around.
Yeah.
But yeah, I often think the grandpa he would have been makes me want to... Yeah. Because I know he would have been a really good grandpa.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a difficult dad, but he would have been really good at that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And so it's really hard. And I think all you can do is tell the stories and show the photos and make them alive as much as you can. And know that the way they parented you will make you a good parent.
Absolutely.
That's all you can
do. That's the thing. I mean, your parenting style will inevitably be influenced.
Yeah, of course. Oh, massively. Hear yourself and you're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
I'm just
turning
said
into
that.
The, yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, my first show, I talk a bit about my mum and how much my mum was, you know, a Thatcherite, a strict disciplinarian, fierce as, you know, incredibly fierce. The way she loved was just over the top.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, over the top levels of affection. So her discipline and her love was both really extreme.
Yeah.
and I know that will absolutely reflect in the way that I parent
should that
opportunity arise.
So you said you had the funeral on the Sunday.
Sunday, the 18th, yeah.
What religion are you, if you don't mind me asking?
So our family are Muslim.
Right, okay, yes. Because I was thinking that's a quick funeral. So
yeah.
So it's Muslim and Judaism. You have to be within 48 hours, is that right?
Yeah. So Judaism and Islam is just as quick as possible.
Yeah. It's interesting. I've never actually spoken to someone who has had that quick funeral. I think our funeral was maybe two or three weeks, obviously.
Right, okay.
But I wonder how it is to have something so quick that she's in a hospital and then the next minute, like you said, you're dropping her, you're carrying her body into the ground.
Yeah.
Like, or is that something more that you're used to, the having funerals that quick, so it didn't feel...
So this was my first experience of a funeral.
Really?
Bless
you.
My first experience of a funeral. And it was, when I reflect back on it, the organisation of the funeral and everything happening, my dad, bless him, I guess we'll talk about this in a minute, when you have such a dominating figure as my mother was,
right,
you kind of forget how great the other person is in that relationship.
Yeah.
And my dad has since, and at the time, showed tremendous strength in the way he's dealt with everything. But in terms of organising the funeral, people rallied round, and she's buried about a 7-minute drive from my house.
Wow.
And it was frenetic, but it seemed calm.
Mm.
Frenetic in the pace at which things were happening, but calm in the way in which they were happening.
Yeah.
So it was my first experience of a funeral, and we announced it on the Saturday morning. I remember I set up kind of a WordPress tribute page to my mum, announced it on there, announced it on Facebook, and something useful Facebook did that day. We had about 575 people turn up.
Oh my goodness.
They ran out of space in the mosque that's inside the cemetery.
Wow.
People were praying basically in the car park.
Oh my God.
And it was the most amazing day.
Yeah.
It was my second funeral, actually, because the first funeral, I kind of wiped from my mind, was of my mum's best friend's son, who passed away the year before at age 22. And that was a horrible experience.
Yeah.
It was not because he was 22. It was in the East London Mosque, and they had like 8 funerals in the same time.
Wow.
All the bodies were in a viewing gallery. It was frenetic. People who didn't know the deceased were looking at the bodies. It was just, and now I just remembered it now that I'm talking about it. And in a sense, I was going into the funeral thinking, I hope it's not going to be like that. And it just wasn't. It was on a Sunday. We were the only people there. Well, I say only people 500.
Yeah.
I'm not really a practicing Muslim anymore.
Right.
And I was just following the lead of people who knew better than I did as to what's required.
I think a lot of our generation, you go and you're like, what am I supposed to do?
Do whatever.
Like, what's happening?
Yeah. And I gave it, you know, from the what my parents did teach me, what little I did know, I said prayers, Arabic prayers, Muslim prayers, as best as I knew them. And all of a sudden, my brother and I were beckoned to climb down into mum's grave.
Yeah, you said so. Yeah. So you have to climb into the grave.
Yeah. So the way it works in Islam is you are literally put to rest, laid to rest by, in the case of a woman, someone they're unable to marry.
Okay.
And in this case, obviously, it's her children.
Yeah.
It's her sons. And it's only men that can go through this process. So my brother and I, who aren't the thinnest boys on the planet, found ourselves climbing down a ladder.
Oh, and, my God. Were you like, what?
Yeah. And it's weird when I think about it. I had, you know, 98% of my anxiety was about me having to bury my mum.
Yeah.
But 2% of it was, will I fit? Like... Will we fit in this?
Oh,
right?
Bless you.
Which is an odd anxiety to have. I mean, that is...
But it's these practical things that occur to you. Like,
It's
like we've talked about with the Mack twins. When I and the Mack twins both had the same thing, like, oh, my God, what am I going to wear?
Yeah.
Like, these things, I'm going, I don't have anything nice that's black.
Absolutely.
So I completely understand. That's like, am I going to fit in that?
Yeah.
Wow. So you're climbing down a ladder into the...
So you climb down the ladder and... I went to the side where eventually her head and shoulders would be laid to rest, and my brother was on the other side. And I kind of looked up, and my mum was in this burial shroud, and we kind of just put our arms out, and I remember carrying her. You know, I could hold my mum.
That's really beautiful.
It is beautiful. Yeah. It brought me closer to God, not necessarily to Islam, but it absolutely brought me closer to God, because I couldn't believe that I had the opportunity to not only feel my mum's final rest in place, to know what it felt like, you know, under my bare feet, the sand, it felt like Bali. It was just amazing, cool, soft, and it felt right that that's where she'd be.
Yeah.
And I remember, I didn't even have to particularly convince myself that this was the right thing to happen, even though it was a woman who I absolutely loved unconditionally. So when they lowered my mum's body into my brother's arms, my brother had her legs, I had her head and shoulders. The next thing was to kind of lower her.
Yeah.
And I'd struggled because it is very narrow.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is like, it's a really beautiful idea, but it's tricky.
I'm thinking it's very tricky.
It's tricky to carry out.
And so we somehow managed it.
Yeah.
And, you know, my forehead had... the other side of her grave completely implanted over the top of her. And what you have to do in Islam is once you've laid them, their faces are turned to face Mecca.
Right.
On the right-hand side, so you kind of lay to rest on your right. But my fear is that not only is my mum facing Mecca, but she's also facing an imprint of my buttocks. and that is something that haunts me. And I think to myself, I really hope my mum is not looking at my ass. That is not something I wanted to happen.
As a mum, to be honest, she probably wouldn't mind.
Honestly. Yeah, probably wouldn't mind. Do you know what I mean?
Like, that's something you've seen her whole life.
Yeah.
That's been part of her world.
I know.
That's kind of lovely.
Maybe. I don't.
She's probably looking just past the bum to Mecca.
Right.
So okay. Just,
we'll ignore that.
Yeah.
Because I remember, because I climbed back out, and when I took the tunic off that I wore, it was the unmistakable imprint on the back. And you kind of think to yourself, oh, I can't believe I've done this, but okay.
Well, you can't go back in. I just need to smooth over.
Can you smooth over that bit, please?
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
but in a way, I think that's really nice, because there is a part of you that's down there with her. There's a part of your memory, your print is there.
Yeah.
There's something, even though, of course, it's your bum. You're a comedian.
Yeah. Of course.
Of course.
Of course.
But there's something really nice about that. Of like,
it is absolutely. But at the same time, I am a London-born.
Yeah.
British Asian guy
who
had a very Asian upbringing and also a very English upbringing. And actually, this going through this experience was something I just never imagined I'd be doing.
Yeah.
And I honestly didn't know how it worked. But
Which I think, I mean, is not uncommon.
There were three moments where I got to hold my mum. The first was when, before someone is buried in Islam, they're given a ceremonial bath.
Right, yeah.
So my brother, my half-brother, we had to lift her body out of a coffin. And she was bathed by women. Then we carried the coffin itself to the site of her grave.
Right.
And that was all the men. So my dad and her, his brothers and everything else. And then the final bit was me and my brother.
Wow.
Inside the grave. So we had three opportunities. And in a sense, just those three steps, there's something, you're absolutely right, there's so much solace in knowing I was there every single step of the way.
Yeah.
Getting her prepared for her burial, carrying her to her final resting place, and actually doing it.
Yeah.
And no one can ever take that away from me.
No, and it must, in a way, I would wonder if it helps with the grieving process, because it's very, you're going to have to really accept what's happening to you.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it's really like, you can't be like, oh, they've just gone away, they're in a box, I haven't really seen them. Yeah. It's like, no, I held her, I saw that, I felt that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of, again, it's this thing with traditions, you go, oh, I see why someone thought that was a good idea.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as you well know, the comedy fraternity, there was lots of, you know, rampant atheists who were very dismissive of religion, and that's absolutely fine. You know, I myself don't practice religion anymore whatsoever. But like I said earlier, you know, it brought me closer to the idea of a God.
Yeah.
Because that's just what made me feel comfortable. And when you're right, you know, when you experience these things, you can see why billions of people find peace.
Yeah.
And birth, death, and marriages are three moments where you really see religion come into its own.
Yeah, it does pretty well at those moments.
Do you know what I mean? It really does. Definitely. And that's when you're like, well, actually, they've kind of got it right. You know, the cemetery that my mum's buried in, every single grave looks exactly the same.
Right.
They have the same tombstone. The mound is exactly the same, because in Islam, they say in death, we're all equal. So you can't tell who's wealthy, you don't know who's famous, you don't know, you know, and you walk through the graveyard, there's colonels there, sergeants there, MBEs, OBEs, my mum, you know, and they're all together, but no one knows. And that's also really nice. I find a lot of peace going there, because you're like, well, and they're just mounds of earth. You know, there's no grandeur, nothing. It's just mounds of earth with a tombstone, which says when they're born or something.
I mean, you said it was 7 minutes drive. Do you visit the grave a lot?
Yeah, so I try and go every single week.
Right.
I try and go once a week. And every week the experience is different.
Yeah.
I can't say that over the years it's got easier. Mm. It's just every week is different. Some weeks I won't necessarily feel anything. Actually, I know I'll be praying, but I'm thinking about, oh, I need to go to Tesco, pick this up. And other weeks it will just be me crying for about a good 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And then going, right, I need to go home now, because I can't cry anymore.
I think that's really interesting, because I think grief, that is the thing with grief, is that it is just different all the time. The sadness gets easier to manage. But I think the only reason because of that is because you know that it will fade. Whereas at the beginning, you're like, I'll never feel happy again.
Yeah.
Whereas as it goes on, you're like, I felt happy, so I know it will come back. So it just gets a bit easy. But it's so interesting that because you have to do that, because you're choosing to do that on such a, like, okay, a weekly thing, you are very aware of how your grief is changing and progressing.
Yeah.
Whereas I think because we didn't have, he was cremated, then my mum kept his ashes in the wardrobe for like 15 years because she didn't know what to do with them.
Right.
And then eventually we spread them. So there's not like a place I feel that I would go to.
Right.
So my grief is very like, I wouldn't be able to sort of, register it as much as being like, oh yeah, this week was harder, this week. It's just, sort of go, oh yeah, today I was feeling, or actually, maybe the past few weeks have been bad. You know what I mean? So I think it's kind of must be nice that you have this like a check-in moment every week.
Yeah.
You're like, how am I feeling? Oh, I know.
Yeah, in a sense. And I kind of do it without realizing I'm doing it.
Yeah,
You know, the cemetery gives me, the graveyard gives me an opportunity to not only process my grief, but leave it there.
Yeah.
You know, and I go through the gates and I don't know what I'm feeling. I go to the grave, feel what I feel, it's done, and then I go out and carry on about
my day. Do you go by yourself or your family, or do they go separately?
Again, it depends. It depends on who's available, who's around, who's doing what. You know, my dad is a paramedic, he has different shifts and he can't always go. My brother when he's around. So, and again, I don't know when I prefer. I know there are some days where I absolutely prefer my brother to be there with me.
Yeah.
But I don't really have a preference. But it's changed, you know, the first, so in Islam, there's a 40-day mourning period, they say. So in the 40 days, what they say is after someone's deceased, the angels are kind of doing admin. They're kind of getting stuff together.
Preparing. We all know it takes a lot of organisation.
Yeah, you've got to go through all the good stuff, bad stuff they've done. And they go to the deceased and they're like, right, this is what happens at your day of judgment. This is what the interview is. Really, you know, quite an intense process. So I remember during those 40 days, of course, I'd go every day. But there were some days where I'd go in the morning and just sit there till the evening, just in front of her grave, not doing anything, just staring.
Wow.
And trying to work out, you know, and people from the graveyard who have clearly seen this before would come, give me water and not say a word and lead me to it.
Wow.
And, you know, so it's of course it's changed from that, but
yeah.
It is nice. In many respects, it is very, very nice, the situation I have.
There's a strong infrastructure, I feel, for dealing with a death. That's what I'm getting from this, from what you're saying. There's a strong infrastructure of people who have dealt with death, understand it. This is what we do. This is how we get through it. I think the reason I think it's interesting is immediately after death, it's so chaos, you know, and you do just feel like, I mean, yeah, I remember like I didn't know what day it was. I didn't know what I'd eaten. I didn't know what the fuck was going on.
Yeah.
So I imagine to have that sort of, and again, it's, my mum used to say this, that, you know, in the olden days, when her granny died, they had a mourning period and they would wear black armbands to school. And that's what like the kids did.
Right.
And so then everyone in the, you know, school and the town knew you were mourning and would be like, oh, fair play. They might be a bit sad. And of course, you know, we don't acknowledge it in that same way. There's not a time period. It's very amorphous. It's very like, oh, well, who knows? Yeah. But imagine to have that 40 days. I mean, it might be restrictive. It might be, I wonder if it's like, okay, well, you've had your 40 days now. Come on, move on. But in a way, it's like you go, okay, well, at least I know for this what I'm doing.
Yeah. Basically,
I know what
I'm
doing for 40 days. I'm just going to be really sad.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are certain verses in the Quran and certain verses in the Hadith, which is kind of, the Hadith is the life and times of the Prophet Muhammad, which goes alongside the Quran. So they do say that after 40 days, technically, you're not really, quote unquote, allowed to weep by the grave because you are not giving the deceased peace.
God, that's so interesting.
Right?
Because for one hand, I'm like, oh, it's quite helpful because it's where that's coming from, obviously, is like, don't get lost in your grief, move on. But on another hand, it must be quite annoying if you're like, I'm still crying after 40 days, don't make me feel bad
about it, exactly.
Yeah, like, you know, of course you're going to cry.
Don't do a classic religion guilt move, right?
Yeah.
Don't do it on me. And they say, you know, you shouldn't be weeping. You want to give the deceased peace. But because they frame it that way, you kind of are a bit like, okay, I've got to try, because you believe that the deceased has an afterlife and they're going and...
And I mean, I guess what it's coming from is not healthy to keep going to the grave, like every day.
Yeah.
So it's coming from a very practical point of view, but they've made it classic religion. Yeah. They've made a rule.
Yeah.
So how did you feel after 40 days? Did you feel like, I actually still feel terrible and I don't feel ready to move on, or?
I felt numb.
I'm not surprised after such a shocker.
Yeah. Like, I felt numb, and even to this day, to be honest, I don't look at any pictures of my mum.
Wow.
Yeah. I can't bring myself to do it.
Are there pictures in the house?
There are pictures in the house.
And you just sort of avoid them?
Yeah. I avoid them. About a month before she passed, my dad had a brainwave where he bought this massive heart-shaped photo frame, which had about 12 different places where you can put. And he just put the pictures in of mum, mainly of mum, actually. Wow. Apropos of nothing, just like, oh, I'm bored, I will do this. And that's in our main kind of communal living room, which makes it sound like I have a massive estate, and I don't. It's a 3-bed semi in Tadwell Heath. But the communal living room, and I just don't make any eye contact with it.
Yeah.
So, in truth, after the 40 days, it's numb. Mm. And actually, even now, probably, there's just a numbness.
Have you had counselling? Have you spoken to anyone?
No, so this is where... there's a bit of an issue. There's a bit of an issue coming out here.
Tell me about it.
So I immediately sent my dad and brother for counselling.
Wow, you did the classic, everyone else should go to counselling.
Yeah. I was like, right,
I hear you.
You guys need to go counselling. This needs to happen. Dad, you were married to this woman, you know, for 30 plus years. You've been through a lot together. And my brother, you know, you're 19 years old. You don't deserve this happening.
Yeah.
You're in the first year of uni. You need to get on top of this. I, on the other hand, was like, I've got comedy. You know, I don't need any of this.
Classic comedian.
Classic.
Such a classic. I'm fine, guys. Yeah. Look, I'm laughing, so I'm fine.
Yeah. And you know what? When I reflect on things like that, I think to myself, you are such a stereotype.
Yeah.
This is embarrassing.
Well, that's okay. That's why stereotypes exist.
Yeah, exactly. So I haven't done any counselling since. Yeah.
Did they find it helpful? Did they sort of come back
and
say
it was helpful? Yeah, they did. What's been nice with my dad and brother is when they've stopped, when they feel like they're struggling, they themselves say, actually, I think I need to go back.
Mm.
And a part of me knows that this is probably something I need to do.
Yeah.
Because I know full well that there's a part of me that's keeping my mum alive.
Yeah.
I got signed a year after starting comedy. I had some amazing gigs, amazing opportunities, things I never imagined I'd be doing. Whenever I hear the news, I pick up my phone and go to call my mum. And she's still listed in my favourites.
Yeah.
And the fact that I still have that instantaneous reaction means I haven't quite processed something.
Well,
maybe?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a constant processing, really. And I think I totally understand. You know, I totally understand. I mean, my husband lost his mum 4 years ago and they were very close. And he still, yeah, still has that moment of like, oh, the first person I want to tell is my mum.
Absolutely. And he must have done when the baby arrived.
Oh, yeah. Baby and work, anything. Work, you're like, oh. And I think, it does... It takes such a long time for that not... Because, of course, you've spent your whole life going, oh, I'll just call my mum and tell... Oh, I can't do that.
I
used to wake up all the time, like, after my dad died and be like, oh, I wonder if dad... Oh, hang on. I was dead. Like... It's so... And your brain, you think to yourself, I mean, how did you forget that?
Like, absolutely.
What is wrong with you? But your brain, you know, of course you do.
Yeah.
I think that's normal. But I think it's interesting. I didn't go for counselling when it first happened. And my mum and brother did.
Right.
And
did you send them all?
I was very, you guys should go. That's a really good idea. And equally, whenever I talk to anyone, I'm like, oh, you should go. But I only went last year. I only went 18 years after he died.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that
so
gives me hope. Okay.
You've got plenty of time.
Right. Fine.
You can go at any time. That's why I say to people, counselling won't disappear.
Mm.
You can go any time. But I think what's interesting is if you go early, I think you go back and you have a support system. And I think that's the one problem with not doing it. If you go when you're completely raw and you're just like, I just fucking need to talk to someone.
Yeah.
The next time you feel bad, you're like, oh, I know, I should go and talk to someone. That will help.
Yeah.
I think if you get through it by yourself, you sort of develop strange coping mechanisms.
Like
comedy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you're like, oh, shit, I'm dealing with it by myself. Which, you know, sometimes is great, but sometimes I think it really does help just to have someone go, are you aware of what you're doing?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think... If you want to go, it's there for you. I would probably wait till after your first Edinburgh show. Get that out the way.
I might just need separate counselling just for that.
Yeah, you will. Honest. You'll need one for the Edinburgh show and one for dealing with the passing of mum. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Does your mum feature in your comedy a lot? Or?
Well, it's interesting. I'd say probably a year after she passed was the first time I started talking about her death specifically.
Wow.
And... comedy audiences did not laugh because they were trying to enjoy their Friday night, right?
So, I think it depends on the gig. Like if you're doing circuit, it might be quite hard. If you're doing like what I do, which is like 10 people, weird.
Yeah.
Like, then they're well up for it.
Well up for that kind of stuff. But in my Edinburgh show, and this is one I found really interesting, I do talk about my mum, but not... And this is where the interesting bit comes in. When I listen back, I mix between the tenses.
I was just going to ask you if you did that, yeah.
So my mum is, my mum was, and I don't actually mention that my mum's passed away.
Well,
that's not a huge part of my show.
Yeah.
How my mum raised me is a huge part of my show.
Right.
So that's something I'm grappling with at the moment when I listen back to the recordings, because I don't know which tense to refer to her in.
Yeah. It's tricky, isn't it? Because if the show isn't particularly about her passing, then do you need to make a thing of it?
Yeah.
But I tell you what, I'll definitely tell you that if someone has lost a parent, they will notice. I very much notice when people change. Sometimes people go, oh, my brother is, and I think, your brother is, why have you said that? Like, I know that he's dead, kind of thing. So I pick up on it a lot more.
Right.
I think if you don't, you wouldn't, if you're not so tuned into like...
To that, yeah. I think you may be right, yeah.
So, maybe your audience, some of your audience might go, whoop.
Yeah.
But 90% probably be like, oh, I didn't even know.
But what was interesting is, so I did this in Bristol last week. I talk about both my parents in my show. And I talk about my dad as, my dad was this kind of guy, my dad was that kind of guy. And I found myself saying, by the way, my dad's not dead. It's just because I'm talking about how you raised me in the past. That's
right,
it.
Right, yeah.
Whereas my mum, I don't refer to it at all.
Yeah.
I don't refer to the was or the is. And that's something I'm finding very difficult.
Do you think you don't want to say to an audience, oh, my mum's dead, by the way?
No.
Yeah.
I don't want to, and I don't know why. I don't know if a part of me is thinking, because it's my debut show, I don't want to be the dead mum guy.
Yeah,
I don't, you know, because I talk, you know, I've written big posts about my mum passing on Facebook, and the comedy fraternity certainly know that my mum's not around anymore. But that's something I'm absolutely grappling with at the moment, which is how I talk about my mother, because
it's really hard. Yeah. It's really hard because you're having to develop a new vocabulary.
Yeah.
And I think that is hard. Yeah. You know.
And I think over the next few weeks, because it is weeks now until Edinburgh.
Yeah, sorry. I'm afraid.
That's something I'm going to hopefully nail down.
Yeah.
But it's tricky to know, because I'm very happy and able to talk about my mum not being around anymore with anyone.
Yeah,
and I think it's very important to talk about these things. We don't talk about death enough, which is why I absolutely love this podcast. So I'm very pleased that you're doing it. But in terms of comedy performance, unless you're in comedy, which you and I are, and listeners who aren't, you know, crafting words which are true to your experience but also something you don't want to share, for many reasons, both personal, professional, whatever it might be, it's such a tricky balance.
Yeah, I completely understand. I mean, I would never have done this podcast when I started. Like, never in a million years. Like, so I was doing characters.
Yeah.
And my whole point was, I don't want you to know anything about me. That's why I didn't do stand-up.
Right.
So I am best friends with Sarah Pascoe. And she started doing stand-up. And I would watch her. And I was like, I thought what she was doing was amazing. But I was like, oh, I can't stand there and go, hi, I'm Carrie Ad. Oh, my God, the thought of saying it. But when you go, hi, I'm Joey, and I'm this, it's like, oh, great.
Yeah.
Literally, I'm so happy doing that.
Playing a character.
And I think I definitely was not comfortable with this huge thing that was a huge part of me. I was like, I don't want you to know. I don't know. Yeah, again, I'm not sure why. I just felt like it was mine, and I wasn't ready to just have people know that. I felt like I was like, no, I don't want you to know that yet.
Yeah.
I'm still processing it. And it's taken a long time to be able to go, hi, I'm Carrie Ad, and my dad is dead, and this is what the show is about. Like, ugh. I never would have done that.
Done that, right, yeah.
Ever. My God, no. It took a long time. I suppose also with comedy, you're finding your voice anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
So then something as big as that, it's like, yeah, I can completely understand. It's a huge thing.
But here's what's interesting. Listen to what you've just said. My first job out of university, I worked in banking. I was on a banking graduate program. And we went to one of these wanky leadership retreats in the Lake District where we wanted to find out about ourselves. And I remember one of my colleagues, a girl called Amanda, we were doing this kind of feedback thing. And in the graduate group, I was one of the more ebullient kind of loud members. And her feedback to me was, I think you're like this because you'd rather be someone else than yourself.
Mm.
I was like, oh, Amanda. Amanda, that's pretty powerful stuff.
There's some deep stuff in the Lake District.
Deep stuff in the Lake District. And also, we're working in banking. I don't need you to be that deep. We're just trying to make money. So when I reflect on that and what you've just said, on stage, I am basically me.
You're right, yeah.
I am basically myself, and everything I say is true plus some comedic license.
Yeah.
But that's the one bit which I'm not, I know I'm not being true to myself because my brain is still, and it's now that I think about it, maybe this is why I need counselling. It's really good. Carrie Ad, flying for counselling. I know that I'm being myself completely, but this one part of my vernacular and what I'm saying just isn't quite coming together.
Yeah.
And I don't know why. But I do know why, but I need to
work it out. It's hard. I think it's hard. It's hard because like 3 years is really early. You're still really raw in it. Because the first year is just chaos. It's chaos. What the fuck happens in the first year? Second year, you sort of go, oh, okay, I'm still here, and you sort of get back to life a little bit.
Yeah.
And third year, people just don't know. So, like, in terms of friends, obviously people remember, but it's very, you know, like, they've talked to you about it. They've done it. They've had that conversation.
Yeah.
And you're expected, you know, almost like the 40 days. Like, I think there's a three, you know, well, come on, you're probably going to get on with life now.
Yeah.
But it's still so raw. It's still so huge. You still have moments where you feel like your heart's going to crack open.
Yeah.
So, yeah, of course, when you're having to, yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Stand-up is so much about being yourself turned up to, and character is so much about hiding yourself and then turning up to.
Yeah.
And I completely understand that that's a part of you that you're still grappling with and still getting your head around. So, yeah, it is hard. And I think it's interesting as well that you are still talking about your mum, because, of course, in a way that is nice to remember when she was alive and have those stories when, you know, you're talking about the happiness of that.
Yeah. My mum was such a huge part of my life. I mean, like I said, I lived with her and I called her 4 times a day.
Wow. You were really close to your mum.
Yeah. And my weekends, because she was at home all week, my weekends, and my friends will attest to this, were spent ferrying my mum around London to see her friends.
Wow.
Basically, I mean...
She got it worked out. I like the sound of this lady.
Yeah,
she was... That's what you want your kids to do.
Yeah, she was basically like, you've had your week. You've had 5 days.
Wow.
The rest of it is mine. So
I love her. It's amazing.
Sometimes if I had no plans, she'd call me. We live in Romford, which is on the east side in Essex.
Yeah.
And for some inane reason, a majority of my mum's friends live in Harrow, which is in the west.
Oh, it's miles away.
And she'd call me as I'm coming home from work. She goes, where are you? I said, I'm coming home from work. And she goes, right, I'm in Stanmore. When you get home, get the car, pick me up. I'm like, that's my evening gone. She's
oh my God.
All right, no, that's what you're meant to do. I'm like, yeah, okay, fine. And it was codependent. It was a codependent relationship. Yeah. I know that. But I loved it.
Mm.
So talking about mum, even when she was alive, I talk about my mum, the stuff that she did, because it was bonkers. So now in her death, I'm talking about her, but how I talk about her and the tenses I use is still a huge thing that I'm trying to understand.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like she was a massive part of your life. It wasn't, because I think some people, obviously people are close, but it's, you know, it sounds like you had a very intense relationship with her.
Yeah.
So that is hard when that goes, because you said codependent and then the thing you were leaning on isn't there. So that is...
Absolutely. So when, and in a sense, my and it's odd to admit this, my 29 years, my social existence after my mum changed changed overnight, because, like I said, I called her 4 times a day. My weekends were spent with her. I'd take her, you know, I'd support her grocery shopping, her friends, whatever else. And I was happy to do that.
Mm.
When she passed, my diary became empty.
Wow. So for the first time, you had sort of ownership over your time,
I guess. Yeah, I had ownership over my time, and I was kind of like, I don't have to do this stuff anymore.
Yeah.
But I wish I could.
Yeah.
And, you know, in 3 years, the people that I saw pretty much every single week, I've not seen them once.
Wow, yeah.
Because I've, you know, now I'm doing comedy and I'm all over the country, you know, doing this stuff. So the nature, I don't want to call it the nature of my existence because that makes it sound much more grand than it is, but the nature of my interactions with the people I had for 29 years has completely changed.
Yeah.
There are family friends of mine who I've known since I was a baby who are getting married, and a lot of comedians will attest that they have to sacrifice going to weddings and stuff.
Yeah.
But also, you know, I was the guy that, with my mum, I'd choreograph the Bollywood dances that would take place at their weddings. I'd be the guy that organises how the bride would come in and all this kind of stuff. Now I'm not doing any of that.
Wow. Does it feel, like you said, do you miss it, or do there is it mixed? Is there a part of you that's like, actually, it's quite nice to have to be completely independent?
It's incredibly nice to be completely independent. Yeah. And actually, when I think about it, it's nice that I don't do that stuff anymore, because that's something I entirely associate with my mum.
Yeah, perhaps that's why you don't see them as well.
Perhaps. Yeah. And, you know, perhaps I just feel too uncomfortable in those situations, which is why I don't do them anymore. But yeah, the nature of everything I do now has completely changed.
It doesn't surprise me that you've had such a massive career change then. Because like you said, comedy, which again, I guess if you don't know a comedian, it takes up everything. It takes up every evening and every weekend. Like it's all consuming. And that's what I mean about, like, it's not a career. It's a it's a cliche, but it is a passion.
Because
so much of it's unrewarding.
and a madness.
You have to kind of really like doing the gigs for no people to no money. The other way around. So you couldn't, like you said, there's no way you could have, if you had, having that relationship with her, there's no way you could have done stand-up, because it does require so much of you.
Yeah.
So I suppose, do you feel like your success has come in a way because you've been able to dedicate this, you obviously had a large chunk of time that was taken by your mum, and that was able to be filled with comedy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I basically had nothing else.
Yeah. So do you have that thing? Because I think I've got friends who found comedy after tragic incidents.
Yeah.
And so for them, comedy becomes, it's like a religion. It's like their love. It really means something. It's not just like, oh yeah, I do comedy. It's like it helped me when I was really low.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that?
Absolutely.
It?
So so now comedy and I have a codependent relationship.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you know what I mean? Even in a similar kind of vein with my mum, I would begrudgingly go to places just to perform comedy to, as you say, five people, whatever it might be. Whereas I did a couple of weeks ago to six people in Brighton in the hottest room on the planet where one man fainted.
Oh, no.
And a very important person to my Edinburgh run was in the room. And her feedback afterwards was, you need a new structure, new jokes, and possibly a new director. But don't worry, you've got 7 weeks. So I was like, okay then.
Oh, my God.
So yeah, that's the kind of...
That's the joy of comedy, guys.
That's the joy of comedy, guys. Mm. So, yeah, absolutely. I am able to... Look, success is so objective.
Yeah.
Objective, you don't really know. But I know that things are going pretty well for me so far, and I'm happy with the progress I'm making. And I know that a big part of it is simply because I have time that has been afforded to me by my mum's passing.
Yeah. And it doesn't make, you know, it doesn't make you not sad or, like, not heartbroken. It's just, like, the practicalities of someone dying.
Yeah.
My dad was a really big character. Huge. I always, the only way I can think is, like, you just knew he was in the room.
Right, yeah.
And when he died... there was a bit of guilt because I always feel like we all breathed a bit more. Just because there was a bit more room.
Yep.
And that doesn't mean we weren't sad. Of course we were sad and of course we were heartbroken. But I definitely, like saying, my mum definitely kind of sort of came out of her shell and blew because suddenly there wasn't this huge presence. And it's a hard hard feeling because I think there was a bit of guilt of like, oh, am I...
Yeah.
It's not like I'm happy about it. It's just things happen when someone isn't there.
Yeah.
Just practically.
Yeah. I mean, in my home, there is less shouting and fewer arguments.
Same.
Yeah. And that's
there's
the truth.
There's so much less shouting. Yeah, and definitely.
The less shouting, the fewer arguments, you know, listeners might think that sounds like a fraught, unhappy household.
No.
But it just wasn't. It was just my mum's character was, her default was to shout her instructions. that was her default. She had, and you had to kind of be like, mum, you're really loud.
Yeah.
So my house is kind of the sixth house down the road from the junction.
Right.
I remember coming out of the station, walking, getting to the junction. I could hear my mum screaming at my brother.
Wow.
She was that loud at the end of the street. And I came home and I said, mum, I could hear you from the corner of the street. Yeah. She's like, don't you start as well. They're going to hear as well. Like, right, okay, right. What's happened? Oh, he hasn't hoovered or something. You know, something ludicrous like that. So... Yeah, it's weird. People will think when they hear this, and when I speak to my friends and say, because of my mum not being here, I'm able to do comedy. Mm. It's less shouty. There's fewer arguments. They might think that sounds like a bad relationship.
Yeah.
But it just wasn't.
Yeah.
That's just her characteristic.
It's hard to explain, I think, if your parent was a character.
Yeah.
Because I know what you mean. I had a difficult relationship with my dad, but. Yeah, the way we communicated was shouting, swearing, just a lot of arguing, a lot of arguing, and a lot of like literally just walking off being like, oh, fuck you.
Yeah.
But that didn't mean we had a bad day.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was like, oh, yeah, we were just talking about who was doing the washing up. That
and that's why you may recall when I talked about what happened to my mum, one of the most memorable moments was that I recalled not having an argument with her
of course.
In Costco on the way back. And it's such a weird, vivid memory to have that I just didn't argue with her. And I don't know why. Mm. And it was always from a place of love. But the fact that I always remember that to other people might seem absolutely ridiculous.
Mm.
But it's a big part of... And actually, I do... Weirdly, you never realise the things you miss. I really do miss my mum calling me.
Yeah.
And even though there were times where I was like, okay, you're calling me 7 times in 2 minutes, it's too much. Not seeing her come up on my phone, which is where I remember seeing her a lot, is something I find very difficult. And I just recently changed my phone and it picked up my old contacts and it put my mum back in my favourites again, which I had deleted.
Oh, God, phone. You've done something brave. Yeah.
And then I was like, actually,
Yeah.
I like seeing the letters MUM
when
I open the contacts list.
Yeah, it's nice.
It gives me something. I don't know what, but it gives me something. And it's just weird that I missed that because at the time I was like, she's doing my nutting.
Yeah.
And I don't know what she's going to call me about. to give you a sense of how mad she was, I used, you know, my first job was in private banking, which is a very kind of It's a very posh, quiet place.
Yeah.
In the heart of Mayfair, we shared a wall with Claridge's.
Wow.
And the guy, my colleague, a guy called Hugo, of course his name was Hugo.
Of course, yeah.
His great-granddad designed the England-Scotland Railway. He went to Eton himself. Like,
okay.
That's the kind of stock we're talking about.
I'm in the room with you.
You're in
you.
The room.
I got you.
Right. Mahogany tables, all that kind of stuff. Anyway, I get a phone call on my mobile phone. My mum is literally screaming down the phone. And I put the volume down.
Quick.
She's screaming. I obviously look a bit shell-shocked by the conversation. Put the mobile phone down. And Hugo says to me, "Who was that?" And I said, "Oh, it's my girlfriend. Or, you know, she's upset about something." And he was like, "Okay, we know it's your mother. Why is the Ayatollah unhappy now?"
Oh my god!
So my mum earned the nickname Ayatollah.
Oh my
I went
god.
Home a few days later, you know, and I said, "Mum, you do realise at work because of the way you shout at me on the phone, they call you the Ayatollah." My mum said, "Oh, look, I quite like that." No, Mum, he didn't say it in a good way.
Of course he did. She was like, "Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I am the
Ayatollah. Afraid. Yeah. Be afraid, everybody."
And then when because my colleagues, Hugo, Paul, Emily, they came to my house for dinner.
Aww.
The day after, my boss, Paul, was invited by the Queen to St. James's Palace for a private dinner because he was the guy in line to look after her bank account at Coutts & Co. My mum was like, "Oh my God, I can't believe he's coming to a 3-bed semi in Chadwell Heath the day after he went to St. James's Palace." But Paul was very kind. She met Hugo. Hugo said, "Ah, hello, Mrs. Akbar, pleasure to meet you." And my mum said, "No, I think you've got a proper title for me." And Hugo looked at me. He's like, "Are you serious? I think you need to..." He said, "Ayatollah?" And she goes, "Wonderful, thank you very much." And I was just like, "What is this? This woman is mad. And she's my mum. I don't..." Okay.
She sounds awesome.
She was mental.
She sounds brilliant. Yeah. She sounds really brilliant.
She was great.
Oh, Ishan, thank you so much for coming in to talk to me about your very brilliant mum.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You can follow Ishan on Twitter at Ishan Akbar. And he's heading up to Edinburgh this year with his new show, Profit Like It's Hot, which he's currently previewing around the country. So do have a look at his website to see where he's gigging and where you can see him. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast or email us thegriefcast@gmail.com. Music is provided by The Glue Ensemble. You can buy their album if you head to their website, theglueensemble.com. And the show is produced by Kate Holland. And remember, you are not alone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.